Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
The spirit of performance is what defines Acura. And now, it's electric. Introducing the ZDX, Acura's most powerful SUV yet. Crafted using the same formula that brought them electrified supercars and multiple IMSA championships, the ZDX has track-tested performance that packs an energy all its own. Unlock the energy and order yours at Acura.com.
Hello, this is the China Sports Insider Podcast. My name is Hyke Valian, and I am with Mark Dreyer. He is the China Sports Insider, and we are both back in Beijing.
Reunited.
For the first time in 6 months. And we have a guest this week live in the studio. I can barely believe it. Mark, how are you doing?
It's great to see you again. We kind of did a bit of a double take at your door just a moment ago when I was like, I feel like I've talked to you every week, because we do. But
yeah.
It's like actually seeing you in the flesh. Is it real? Yes, it is.
Have I changed at all?
I'm going to try and avoid answering with respect to your beard. You know, we kind of did that, I think, over the Olympics. But no, looking great. Hyke is looking great for our listeners here. We're not live streaming this one, but he is looking...
Probably just a few more gray hairs on my part.
Maybe one or two.
How is it possible that you have none? It's amazing.
Well,
incredible.
I have just less hair overall.
Yeah,
anyway.
I didn't know that. Well, Mark... I'm excited because we have a guest today, and he's coming up really, really soon. Who are we talking to today?
So Feng Tao is one of the co-founders of Shanghai Sports, which was a sort of a Swiss-Chinese JV, really, in terms of the founding partners, sports marketing company. And they've been involved in some of the biggest sports sponsorship deals for Chinese companies when it comes to international sporting events like the World Cup and the Olympics. And, you know, Feng Tao he's just a great guy, extremely knowledgeable with decades of experience on the sports industry. So we'll be talking to him about football, about the Olympics, and just about the sports industry here in general.
Let's talk about a couple of topics that we were looking at. You know, looking at your Twitter stream, as I, you know, do all the time, really. And you you mentioned or you talked about marathons that are coming up here in China that I guess have been canceled, and one that has not been canceled just yet.
So I kind of had a bit of a personal connection here. I got out of quarantine. I actually tried to get into the Beijing Marathon, which is supposed to be coming up this coming weekend,
right?
But I didn't have an official registered time for a marathon and a half marathon within the last 3 years, so I wasn't able to get into that. But I was signed up for the Great Wall Half Marathon. And then that got postponed, I think, for about the third time until the end of November. That was going to be actually just this past weekend. And over the weekend, I noticed there were about 9 or so. I'm in some of these, you know, running enthusiast groups where people are just training for races all over the country and triathlons and so on. And someone had posted there were 9 races that were canceled 1 week out, which I thought was pretty significant, because this coming weekend is supposed to be the Beijing Marathon. And I just thought... cases are rising here in the capital, all over the country. People are kind of on edge, you know, up to 3,000 cases, which nationally is a very high number for China. As of this moment, it's still on, but I put it sort of 50-50. I'd say maybe I'm going to even go 40-60 in terms of not happening, just because I don't see Beijing authorities willing to take the risk. Because, you know, as always, and we've talked about this, you know, politics always comes first.
Just a little bit of context, Mark. Like, what place does this race hold in, say, internationally in the past? Like, did runners ever come here?
Well, pre-pandemic, you would have some elite runners coming to the top marathons in China. This would be a big one. This would be pretty significant. You know, it's the capital's main race, and it starts near Tiananmen Square and then ends up near the Olympic Park. I mean, it's a big race, and it's fairly prestigious on the Beijing sporting calendar, but I'm just not sure that it's that prestigious enough for it to go ahead at all costs. I really hope that it does, and it'll be just interesting in terms of an indication as to whether it does or not. It was kind of interesting that almost the moment where they said, "Right, we've here are the lottery winners for the entrance." It's all come together very quickly. The entrance applications was only opened a few weeks ago, and it's supposed to be coming in just a few days. But that speaks to another thing. You know, how long does it take for your average amateur runner to train for a marathon? Well, you need a little bit more than a few weeks.
And
so
a few weeks,
what people have been doing here, and I have a lot of friends who are doing this, they're basically just constantly training and entering as many races as they can, expecting most of them to be canceled. And then if anyone does come off, then they're like, hey, this is a bonus. And so if you just reset your expectations to, I will always get a refund for these things. You know, I had another friend, she was like, well, I can't do that because I have another race that same day, but actually my train's been canceled because they won't let me in and out of Beijing, the direct train between,
Nightmare. No. Well, okay, and another thing you mentioned earlier was that the race for the Great Wall Race was postponed.
Yeah.
To when?
It's hey, so you don't cold. Want you know when you're running a marathon, particularly when you're climbing up these hills, you don't want it too hot.
You don't want it too hot. Yeah. That's true. But man,
end of November, so it's just about okay. You know, maybe a pair of leggings. I'll make it a game to game.
You're gonna have to really love. You're gonna have to really love running. Which you know it's. God, that's too much. Okay, so that's the marathon. Another story that we're kind of looking at was that China is bidding or might bid for the Women's World Cup in 2031. People are really optimistic that zero COVID will be gone by 2031.
2031. Look, I mean, this has to be a good sign. You know, at least people are making longer term plans. Again, we're a long way off from this coming to fruition in terms of the bid and of course, being accepted. Right now, there is sort of that negative perception about China hosting international sporting events. So they don't want any, they don't want FIFA making a call on this anytime soon, just because we've had the, you know, the Asian Cup from next summer already pulled away from China. So people don't have that positivity about, you know, China hosting these things that they used to. But look, 2031... You'd have to think that the 9 years from now, the sports industry at least kind of has settled into some kind of new normal, whether it's a return to normality or what have you. But yeah, I put this as a good sign. But again, it's so far away from right now that it's hard to read too much into it.
All right, Mark, let's end with this really actually kind of a funny story. And we're going to have to like show this photo somehow to our listeners. What's the story?
So this goes back to the Beijing Olympics from earlier this year, and it's actually a Swiss snowboarder, but he made a bet with his wife. This is a Swiss snowboarder called Jan Scherer. This was his third Olympics. He had yet to win a medal, and basically he said if he was to win a medal in Beijing, which he hadn't managed to do in either of his previous two Olympics, he would have to get whatever tattoo she wanted him to get. And he was like, look, if I win a medal, any medal, any color, I'm not going to care, right? Yeah. And it's like, you kind of trust your wife's not going to make you, you know, have like a, you know, a ridiculous thing on your face or something like that, right? Yeah. I mean, unless they were kind of, you know, falling out in divorce proceedings. But, you know, it's all so far so good. So he wins bronze medal. And nothing really happened for a while. But then she designed this tattoo and kind of gave it to him. And then he didn't say when he was going to go and get it, but just in the last week or so, he's gone to get this tattoo, and I'll try and explain it here if people can't see the thing. It's basically like, it looks like a kid's drawing, deliberately looks childish, and it's this guy with this sort of the very scrawly Olympic rings on his chest with like a dunce hat saying number 3 on it, I guess for bronze. And the slogan at the top is good, but not the best.
that's you know, not a terrible motto.
Yeah. I mean, hey, good, but not the best. If that means you're an Olympic medalist, I'd say you're pretty great. But yeah, A great sense of humor, both for his wife and for Jan himself for actually going through with it.
What would you ever put yourself in a position like that?
Well, let's be honest, we're talking hypotheticals. For my next Olympic medal.
What if you were like the number one podcast on iTunes? Is
that depends who I was making the bet with, whether it was you, whether it was my wife. I would like to say,
I can tell you, I have no tattoos. I don't know about you.
I'm not going to make you prove it, Heike.
No, you don't have to prove it. I can just take my word for it. Let's move on to our interview with Feng Tao.
Feng Tao, thanks so much for being here. It's great to see you again after so long. I remember we were on a panel together first time I met you, I think, down in Macau, probably about coming on for maybe 7-8 years ago, yeah. Talking about the sports industry, and wow, it feels like a lifetime ago. But I wanted to ask you, first of all, so you founded Shanghai Sports in 2009, and then really a lot of the business, or a main strand of the business, has been helping to get Chinese fans to World Cups and European Championships. So talk about the history and how that's evolved and how that's grown since that first World Cup in South Africa, 2010, up to this year in Qatar.
Yeah, the 2009, actually, after, you know, Beijing Olympics finished in 2008. And the in terms of the sports industry in China, in my personal opinion, is 2008 is kind of a turning point of China's sports industry. Before the 2008, not so many Chinese people who understand the sports industry. And during the preparation of the game for Olympics from 2003 to 2008 is a kind of education process for the Chinese people. And I think that is a turning point, and it makes it more people who feel like, okay, the sporting events, they really can create environment and the let the people who enjoy the games and the that kind of things. It's really make me to think about, all right, why don't we create our own sports marketing company and try to bring all the knowledge and know-how what we're having in the past few years. And then we decide, okay, let's create our own company, sports marketing. So it's 2009. And then I started to think about, what are we going to do? What are we going to do? Because we want to fund we position our company as a kind of a bridge between China and the international world. And because the sports industry in the Western country is pretty well developed. In China, it's kind of from zero. We need to find out what is the best project for us to introduce or to bring our knowledge to the market in China. Yeah. So the first project that we select, the FIFA World Cup 2010 South Africa, and we sign an agreement with the FIFA as the exclusive agent of hospitality sales in China, but we are the last one for 2010 as among all the agencies of FIFA to selling the hospitality package. But the interesting thing is, when we introduce the product into China, when we talk to all the people, all the consumers in China, nobody knows what that means, hospitality. And yeah, basically, this is my experience.
So talk about the numbers. I remember you were, but I want to get the numbers right. In terms of how many Chinese fans traveled to that, I mean, of course, China's only been in one World Cup, 2002, but they still take a great interest in the World Cup as passionate soccer fans. Yeah. So how many fans traveled to South Africa and then again to Brazil, Russia, you know, and obviously a very different situation, Qatar, but just take us through those different tournaments.
Okay, so based on the FIFA regulation and the rules, so basically, you could separate into two parts in terms of the fans. Okay, one part is the normal fans, and all the people who purchase the tickets, regular tickets from FIFA website, and the another part is the hospitality. Yeah. So for the regular fans, based on the FIFA regulations. Every year, every World Cup, probably Chinese people could purchase 3,000 to 4,000 tickets. Yeah, 3,000 to 4,000 tickets. This is the regular tickets. Another part is hospitality. The hospitality. So we worked together with the FIFA in 2010, and just 6 months before the kickoff, we signed an agreement with them. So the in 2010, we took around, I can't remember the correct number, but it's probably 600 to 700 people. Yeah.
Okay.
And the people who purchased the hospitality, yeah.
And then onto Brazil, that rose pretty dramatically, right?
I was just reading, actually, that for this next World Cup in Qatar, Chinese fans have snapped up between 5,000 and 7,000 tickets.
And for the regular tickets, it's basically the FIFA control, the allocation. Yeah. World Cup in Qatar, geographically, it's in Asia. So naturally, they think in the Asian market, where is the biggest market? So they think that definitely is China. It's China, yeah. So they increase the number of allocation for the Chinese market.
Are you expecting, 5,000, 6,000, 7,000 Chinese fans to travel, or are a lot of those tickets going to end up on the resale market? Because, of course, it's still, minimum of 10 days quarantine on re-entry into China right now. It's sort of discouraged a lot of people from traveling. I have one American friend who's been here a long time, but he's going to be out for 3 months, including a few weeks of the World Cup, so he'll kind of do it at the end of that trip. But do you expect that number, though, several thousand Chinese fans, to be going to Qatar?
Personally, I doubt it. And our conversation, like from we started the hospitality 2010, so probably we took the 600 to 700 people. Then the 2012, the European Championship, the in Poland, Ukraine, and 2014 Brazil World Cup, and then the numbers increased. So the 2014 Brazil World Cup, several thousand people who purchased hospitality, and the achievement is the 2018 World Cup. 2018 World Cup, the hospitality, probably we took 15,000.
Right. I mean, that's a lot of people going from China to Russia, yeah. For these packages. And of course, they're not cheap, but it's kind of all inclusive, right? You got the hospitality at the games. Does it include do you also do the whole travel and the hotels as well, or they have to sort that out?
The people could, we provide the variety and different options. Okay. Yeah, yeah. So people could purchase the only hospitality package, or people can, help to find the hotels, accommodation, or transportation, et cetera, et cetera. Yeah.
I mean, the most immediate thing it says to me is that, imagine when China gets into the World Cup again, and we don't know when that's going to be, but imagine how crazy it's going to be in terms of Chinese fans traveling. Like, this is hospitality. There would have been that additional 5,000 Chinese for Russia buying the regular tickets through the website, presumably as well, right? But they're going to watch
even more.
Even more in Russia, right?
Yeah, there's a joke. There's a joke in 2018, among the Chinese community, saying that the 2018 World Cup in Moscow, except Chinese national teams, all Chinese component were there.
Right, yeah. So everything but those 11 players.
Yeah.
So in Qatar for this year, I mean, have you been able to sell any hospitality, or is it basically just down to zero?
Down to zero.
Okay.
Because of the zero COVID policy,
it's
difficult to make people travel.
And at what point, presumably this year, at what point did you just kind of look at each other and say, okay, guys, it's just not going to happen?
I think the people in the market who understand the situation, understand the situation now. Yeah, and everybody, frankly speaking, or as a football fans, everybody want to look at the tournament. But when they down to the thinking about the travel and accommodation, and when they back to from the tournament, I have to get in through the quarantine process, and then the people just give up the idea.
I do want to look at some of the more, you know, I don't know, hopeful stories. So you are going to be going to Qatar because you've also worked with a number of Chinese. The other big story about China and the World Cup, of course, is the sponsors, the Chinese companies that you've brokered many of these deals. And you're kind of helping with the activation for some of these companies in Qatar. So let's start with that. And then maybe we'll talk about, you know, how Chinese fans back home may be celebrating and consuming and watching the World Cup from here in China, despite the, you know, the time difference challenges. But yeah, tell us about the sponsorship side.
Yeah, when the people watching the World Cup, now they're starting from the a few years ago, and then the you can see some Chinese brand showed into old LED around the pitch during the tournament.
Yeah,
that is the, we come to the sports industry or sports marketing conversation. Yeah, so the I think in the last 20 years, 20 or 30 years, the Chinese companies, when they have a desire to go abroad, and domestic market probably is they think, okay, it's a mature, and then they want to develop, and then they want to increase their brand awareness internationally, and then it's come to the question mark for all the big boss from the Chinese brand. What are we going to do? What are we going to do? Yeah, this is the this is the job I did in the last 20 years. Try to convince the Chinese brand to do the big sponsorships during the big tournament. I think that is the most efficient way for Chinese brand to go abroad.
Which are some of the brands that you've worked with, or what would you say have been the biggest successes that you've been a part of?
In terms of football, the FIFA World Cup, you know, basically there are four Chinese company, Wanda, Hisense, Mengniu, and Vivo. There are four Chinese company. We are working basically direct and indirect all of them. But in terms of the details, working on the ground, it's two companies, Hisense and Mengniu. We're working very closely with them.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but it splits. There's obviously, you've got the electronics brands. And so over the years, as we've seen sort of Chinese brands get involved in sports sponsorship internationally, particularly in soccer, there are those brands who are trying to sell their products globally. You know, for example, Huawei, you know, has huge market share in certain countries and it's doing very well. Hisense, you know, televisions, I think saw a huge boost after 2016 when they were in the Euros there. But then you've also got the brands that are basically just advertising back to their domestic audience.
Yes.
And it's sort of the credibility of being a World Cup sponsor. So I was watching the Premier League, English Premier League last weekend, and there were banners, digital advertising banners about Xiaohongshu, the Chinese app, which is, you know, being compared to Instagram, if people aren't familiar with that. And it was just in Chinese, and it was basically saying, you know, chat on our app during the World Cup. So that was the message. It's not, you know, it's not trying to push Xiaohongshu like globally to local fans around the world. So there are those kind of differences. Where does Mengniu, like the dairy provider, are they looking to make inroads overseas, or is that more of the kind of that second group where it's kind of we get the cred for advertising at the World Cup, but really we're just advertising to our domestic market?
I think the first thing is for all the brand, they have their own strategy.
Yeah.
They definitely have their own strategy. So different brand, they have the different strategies. Okay, for Mengniu is they're doing the global sporting event. The benefit for them is it's increasing their brand awareness internationally, and also they create kind of the credibility for them to introduce their brand to all their international partners. So it helped them to, what I've seen in the last few years is this sponsorships with the FIFA, and they helped Mengniu to Do you find more the international partners, either they are going to acquire the farm or land, this is a big benefit for them. And another part is to come to the marketing. Yeah, come to the marketing. And this is the back to their marketing, the LED board showing during the tournament, through the CCTV broadcast. Yep. And then it definitely helped their brand to communicate with the Chinese brand, with the Chinese consumer, sorry. Yeah.
That's really interesting. So a lot of it is kind of B2B internationally, really, that first part. You know, B2B, just like so they're not selling milk around the world, but it's helping them to sign up more dairy farmers and all that sort of stuff. That's I mean, it's quite different, obviously, from like Vivo, who are trying to actively develop markets and sell phones overseas and so on.
Yeah, that is based on my 20 years experience. So what I'm trying to share my philosophy to all my friends in China is that when you communicate with international people, it's better to use their culture to integrate your philosophy, your ideas. It's a very simple way. It's when all my friends or the international people come to China, we help them to use chopsticks. But when I go abroad, I need to learn how to use fork and the spoon. Yeah, that's it. It's very simple.
That's a really interesting point, actually. And I wonder if you can sort of take us into some of those conversations you've had with some of your friends in China. Like, what are some of the biggest misconceptions that some of the clients might have about how to sell to a sort of a global clientele?
Yeah, I know what I mean. It's a very difficult job. It took me starting from the year 2000, by that time I worked for the Asian Football Confederation, and all my boss said to me, hey, FTO, how can you... But you know that by that time, lots of Japanese company, Korean company invested a lot into the international event. And then my friends from AFC asked me, said, hey, FTO, when can you bring a Chinese brand into the international sporting event? I said, okay, let me try. And then when I come back to China and they share this idea to the Chinese brand, and then they said nobody want to do this, and so it took me probably 15 years to share my ideas. By the time I almost give up my lifetime my desires, and then the Hisense, the big pal from Hisense, they got opportunity, and I know them for many years, and then they know I'm working in sports, but they don't know what is the details of what I'm doing, and then I put the opportunity to them, to Hisense, and then they decide, okay, let's do this. And because from 2000 to 2012, Hisense already developed their international strategies already. They have the factories in South Africa, and they have a factory in Australia. They did a lot, and they tried, but So 2015, I really got opportunity to present opportunity to them, and then they decide, okay, let's do this. But my personal experience is, if you're trying to sell this kind of big international sporting events or sport the opportunities for the big boss in China, the big brand in China, you need to get the credibility from them. This is a top of priority. Well, whatever what kind of product you sell to them, but the first thing is you have to get the credibility.
So you're talking about your personal credibility, your company's credibility, or like association with the Euros or the World Cup?
Personal. Okay. Personal. Okay. Personal and the company.
So it takes many, many years to develop these relationships and persuade them this is something they want to do.
Yeah, this is the truth.
Now, talking about long-term connections, I think the benefits, probably from your point of view, is that many of these deals are multi-year deals or multi-cycle deals. So you, if you're signing for like four World Cups, you know, we're talking 16 years there, right? So it's you have that stability. However, and again, this is a kind of a, I guess, a tricky question, but you know, the geopolitically over the last, you know, 2 to 3 years, it's been a struggle, I think. And you know, you see these sentiment surveys about what people think of you know, China, this kind of big bucket, whatever China means. Has that kind of hit the business in any way in terms of perception of Chinese brands? Or are consumers, you know, like they just want a nice phone that's cost, you know, the right price point and as long as it works. Like, how much is this beginning to play into the stuff that you've done, or perhaps it's not?
No. Yeah. So the I know the this is a very interesting question, but what I seen the you know, just to come back from Europe, the I travel in the last few months, I was in Europe and the travel lots of the different cities, and the well, my feeling is so, and the I think in the end the people need the product. Whatever you are, European or the American or the South African, everybody need have product. Everybody to want to buy the cheap, high quality product, which is all the Chinese brand can provide at the moment.
Qatar specifically, tell us about your involvement. What will you be doing? How long are you going to be on the ground there? And what are the activations that you're doing, presumably at the fan zones and the fan facing promotions on the ground in Qatar?
Yeah, based on the contract signed between FIFA and the Hisense and the FIFA and the and Mengniu, they got a certain rights. So they are going to do some the promotion there and the activities, the road shows, and the, apart from the LED around the pitch, they have a lot of things to do. Yeah, and they also have a showcasing activities. So my team, they help and they help them to do the showcasing, the a lot of the underground job. Yeah, and the, even the global summit, and the, because the Hisense achieved a lot in the last few years. From developing the international market, so they got the several hundred people distributors. They invite them to have a global summit. Yeah, the, apart from the Chinese market, because of the travel policy, so it's difficult for Chinese the distributor to go abroad. But for the international, is there's no any impact, and you can feel that the huge demanding from. U.S., from their partner from U.S., from the States, from South America, from Mexico, Brazil, and South Africa, Australia, the Europe. Yeah, the huge demand.
Yeah, that, I mean, that's fantastic to hear. It's just so, you know, just so frustrating that China or the vast majority of, you know, obviously you're going, but the vast majority of Chinese fans and stakeholders just can't really be involved. But you know, as a Chinese soccer fan, Feng Tao, I know obviously China is not yet back in the World Cup. So if you're looking for a team to support, I can strongly recommend England. But Haig might have some...
Well, I mean, if you want to cheer for another country that has only had one appearance so far, that would be, of course, Canada.
Great connection.
I think this is a team that...
We're lobbying for our teams here. Before we kind of talk about the sports industry in general here in China and sort of the current state of play, I wanted to ask you one other deal. You've obviously probably the most high profile deal from my perception, I would say, for Shanghai was with Alibaba and the Olympics. Yeah. Just tell us about how that deal came to be.
No, the Alibaba, the deal signed between the IOC and the Alibaba in 2017. They took a few months to negotiation from both sides, and basically that marriage is help or benefit both sides. It help benefit both sides. But that, you know, the Alibaba as a technology company, and they really can provide a lot of the high technology for IOC, for International Olympic Committee. And also at the same time, the Alibaba e-commerce platform, which can really approach huge amount of the consumers in China. So that to that scenario, it's a kind of the chemical chemistry for the create chemistry for both sides, and they love to marry to each other.
You talk about a marriage. Tell us what it's like to play matchmaker between Jack Ma and Thomas Bach.
Yeah, I think been in a few meetings, but the not all the meetings, and I think they love to each other. Yeah, and they have a kind of a same philosophy by that time. Yeah.
Love at first sight. Sounds good. Yeah. Look, it's fantastic, to hear you talk about all the things that you've been involved in and you know, still involved actively today. I know it's been an incredibly challenging past few years for everyone in the sports industry, and it sounds like you've sort of been able to at least keep parts of the business active and happening but let's talk a little bit more about that. How much have you had to perhaps pivot to other things, and what have you seen in the sports industry as people have sort of adapted to China's ongoing COVID zero policy, and what's that going to mean going forward as well?
I really think about this topic and these ideas in the last few years. But what I think, I prefer to put this into positive way.
Yeah.
And personally, I've been involved. I'm a sports fan, and I play a lot of different sports. But for my friends and the lots of Chinese in the they are not really participating into sports. But starting from when the COVID happened, what the positive things what I've seen is the people understand when something happened, you have to focus to build up your body by yourself. This is what I found out. And then you can see the more people are running on the street. Interesting thing is, I think it's 20, 25 years ago, that I forgot which years. It's the first time when I was in New York or in Europe, I saw the people running on the street. But I said, I think, oh, those stupid guys, why they are running on the street? Why they are running on the street? And now I understand. Yeah.
Well, I mean, we saw that with the push for the winter sports in China and the run-up to the Winter Olympics earlier this year. You know, and I remember last year going to the Winter Sports Expo over at Shougang Park and just seeing all of the Chinese brands, these new Chinese brands, making things like, you know, like skis and helmets and things like that that I don't think was made in China until very recently. Have you been to that expo? And what were your impressions since you've been going to that expo over the years?
Back to 2014, when talking about the sports industry in China. So everybody knows 2014, the Chinese government issued the policy to encourage people to involve into sports. And then they have a different policy, which is the helping investors or the local government to focus into sports, and then starting from that time, and on top of that, and then the 2015, the China bid for the Winter Olympics, and then we call the in our area we call this as the outdoor sports or the mountain sports, and then the people on the ground the suddenly find out they are different. The sports in the end is a kind of a lifestyle. It's a kind of a lifestyle. It really depends on what kind of lifestyle you want to be, and after 20 or 30 years developed in China, so from 1980 or to the 2010, in China, I think there are the big middle class communities which they have their good life, and they need to find out something for their brain, and then the sports is a perfect match or need for themselves. Yeah, and I don't have the official numbers, but all the people working in the industry talking about there are 300 million middle class people, and now they are ready to participate in two different sports. So when you talk to the commercial or the business, from the business wise, 300 million potential consumer. Yes, it's a crazy number. It's a one European market, and also it's the, almost the one entire the US market. So that's why the people start to involve. If as the whatever the professional, the amateurs, so when you stand on the pitch, or the, when you go to the mountain, you need to buy the equipment. So this is the first need for people. So that's why then you can see that the different brands, whatever the Chinese brand or international brand, everybody is looking for the Chinese market, and we're just focusing on the sports industry. So the people need to have equipment, and people need to have a ground to play. That's it. That's as simple as that.
So it's really interesting what you're saying there about sort of this. Growth in domestic sports activity, and that's certainly been one of the big waves that we've seen. You know, after 2014, there was the big soccer push. There was the winter sports, of course, after 2015 when China got, you know, but when Beijing got the 2022 Olympics, and then this sort of mass participation wave of running and cycling and swimming, and I think that has expanded as you've rightly pointed out through the pandemic into gyms and fitness, and we're seeing the explosion of kind of. Some of these niche sports, you know, ultimate frisbee. We did a show on that as well, and you know, people talking about some of these smaller things. Surfing in Hainan, you know, has taken off, and I think because people haven't been able to travel, they've looked inwardly, they've looked within China's boundaries to go skiing instead of going to the Alps or going to North America. Your business, of course, historically has been, as you said, being a bridge between China and the West, or China and the international market. So, have you also had to pivot things in terms of look more domestically over the past few years?
Yes, definitely.
In what ways?
Yeah, we already we have team to start to doing the doing this research, and you see whatever is the mountain sports or the water sports or the indoor sports or outdoor sports. So we are we're working on that. So basically, you know, I'm very confident. In the next few years, people working in sports industry, how those group of people could provide best product into the market. This is what I'm thinking now. Yeah, because now the domestically, I think probably the China market now is similar like the marketing in Europe or States back in 1950 or 1960s. Yeah, that's what I've seen. So there is a huge growth or the huge potential, in the next few years. Yeah.
I guess I have two final questions. If you're speaking to people in the sports industry internationally and they're looking at China and thinking, well, I can't travel there right now. I don't know when I'm next going to be able to travel. But they're hearing about this, you know, this 300 million consumer market, you know, this massive growing middle class. What's the best way for them to try to stay involved with sort of long-term intentions, even though short-term they don't really know how they can be more actively involved? And what would you say to them as they perhaps look at other markets and think, you know, we need to pivot away from China because we just don't know what's going on there right now?
My suggestion is just to come to China and stay here.
All right. So just do one quarantine and suck it up.
Yeah. But I think the China definitely we don't know when international people could travel China without quarantine policies. I don't know when it's going to happen. But 300 million potential consumers there. I think for all the international people, they have to think about this. Mm-hmm. They have to think about this. Yeah, and also that's why I suggest just to come to China, maybe not next year, but you have to plan ahead. You have to plan ahead, and also what I've seen in the last 2 decades. Some international people, which can success in China hugely because they know how to adapt into the market. But some companies, internal companies, they just come and go. It doesn't work. It shows it doesn't work.
Yeah, it's really a two-way thing. As we talked about before, Chinese companies having to adapt overseas, you know, the reverse is also true. And, yeah. And I guess my final question, and perhaps you've already answered this, but you know, what are you most optimistic about? You know, let's try to finish on an upbeat note. You know, what are you most optimistic about the future of the sports industry, despite the challenges that everyone has had over the last few years?
I think I put it into 360 degrees, everything.
Well, that's certainly encouraging news, I suppose. Yeah. But thank you for your thoughts.
Yeah, thanks for the invitation.
Thank you to Feng Tao. The China Sports Insider podcast is host Mark Dreyer. He is the China Sports Insider. Check out his book on Amazon. It's called Sporting Superpower, China's Quest to Be the Best. My name is Haik Balian. Thank you for listening.